Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today is exactly at the cuspidor of March madness and April foolery. I feel inclined to supplicate the customary intangibles of Marpril duality. It is spring after all. I start with Deliberate Extinction Without Guilt by Paul Rafael and Donna Sheehan. For decades, environmentalists everywhere have been trying to make everyone else feel guilty. Humans, they say, are damaging the earth faster than it can repair itself. The environmentalist solution is to tighten our belts, use fewer natural resources, recycle, protect other species, and generally clean up our collective act. Let's face it, that approach doesn't work. All it does is make people feel bad about doing what they are best at, using stuff up and making a mess. Conservation only means saving what's left so we can use it up later. Is that a solution? The amount of time and money that has been spent by environmentalists, corporations, and government on fighting each other on environmental issues is incalculable. That's why a movement called pro-degradation is gaining popularity in Northern California as it spreads its message that it's okay to act like human beings. Once we accept that we are the most productive and destructive species ever created, that we have no choice but to mess up our playpen, we will be able to complete the logical process of humanity toward extinction without guilt. The message of the pro-degradation movement is that we should all speed up this process, make life untenable for the human race before we have time to figure out how to survive. The target is to remove the human presence on the earth within 3 generations. Since we have no choice but to ruin the world for ourselves, we should get it over with as soon as possible in order to spare the rest of the world's species. We'll take plenty with us, no doubt, but the longer we delay the inevitable, the more species will disappear. Pro-deg should be a notion that almost everyone can support. Republicans, Democrats, Greens, corporations, shareholders, Christian fundamentalists, Buddhists, Earth Firsters, pro-lifers, and just regular folks who want to be able to live life, to raise families and spend their hard-earned money. Pro-deg will give everyone the guilt-free impetus to obey the urgings of governments and corporations to spend more and consume more. We are told that a healthy economy is one that keeps growing ad infinitum, that it is the patriotic duty of Americans to buy more goods. This quarter's bottom line is the only consideration, so don't listen to all those whiners who say our way of life is changing the planet. Don't look ahead, buy more. Be proud of human ingenuity. Take the message to every country in the world. Pro-deg supports the manufacture of all products designed to speed the decline of the human species. It therefore stands behind the increased production and use of pesticides, genetically modified crops, nuclear and biological weapons, synthetic food additives, hormones and preservatives, all tested on humans, nuclear and coal-fired power stations, tobacco and carcinogenic substances of all kinds, guns, high consumption gas and diesel engines. Pro-deg believes that lead-based paint and fuels should be reintroduced along with asbestos and mercury products. It supports the abolition of the already neutered EPA, the few existing gun control laws, the FDA, OSHA and ATF, minimum wage legislation, anti-slavery and child labor laws, all environmental organizations, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and food stamp programs, seatbelt and helmet laws, alternative energy programs, if any exist, MALT and other land trusts, state and national parks, which should be privatized. We have all been wrangling over these issues, using up precious consumption and degradation time. While these delaying tactics continue, the world climate is still being changed, or if you prefer, natural processes are being helped along, but not quickly enough. The pro-deggers call on corporations and governments to live up to their promises. A corporation's sole responsibilities, we have heard time and again, are to their stockholders, dividends, and corporate profits. These were never long-term responsibilities. Quarterly profits and the board's benefits are always preferable to long-term planning for future resource management and a healthy customer base. Governments tell us that the only healthy economy is one that grows and grows regardless of the effects on the environment. ProDeg's position is that these organizations were right all along. They want everyone to get behind their governments and the multinationals that rule the human species and spur on their continuing efforts to bring us to our natural fulfillment. There are sections of the American public and government that believe the end time is coming fast, so we might as well live as fast and luxuriously as we can, because pretty soon the four horsemen of the apocalypse will be coming down Main Street, doling out paradise passes to the righteous and death to all the rest. Rumor has it that most of the government's agenda is built around this premise, which explains a lot about economic, foreign, environmental, and judicial policies. None of it matters. The end time is coming. So, the pro-deggers expect to see wide support from the Republicans, their corporate sponsors, patriots, and fundamentalists of all creeds. They also expect support from these and other anti-abortion activists. Since the concept of pro-deg is to consume as much as of the planet's resources as quickly as possible, population must increase faster than it already is. The pro-deggers call for the outlawing of birth control in any form, including abstinence and abortion. The goal is to increase population, with each person consuming as much as possible, hence the need for maximum birth rate, something that Catholics and fundamentalists and pro-lifers have long been working towards. Maximum birth rate will have many social implications. Since our primary values as humans is to keep our global economy growing through higher consumption, maximum birth rate will mean increased demand for goods with corresponding profits for corporations. That will create a need for greater output and workforce. With the maximum birth rate in effect, there will be plentiful supplies of labor willing to work for next to nothing. With repeal of anti-slavery and anti-child labor laws and the enactment of laws requiring maximum procreation by everyone, the manufacturing sector will be able to consume vast resources in a very short time. Maximum birth rate may require mandatory consumption of fertility drugs. Imagine a bright American future in which the birth of sextuplets, which today is so loudly applauded by the press as the epitome of family values, will become the norm. With the proper education, a child will no longer simply mean one more future car on the road. It will mean maximum procreation, maximum consumption, and maximum degradation. All three natural, God-given functions of the human being. Environmentalists will get behind pro-deg, too. If they truly want to save the planet, not just force it to put up with us for a couple of more centuries, this is the only way to go. They can also take a much-needed rest, quit worrying so much, and find out what it's like to be a true citizen of the Western world. Trade in the Volvo, buy a Ford Expedition, buy two. After all, even the most avid of ecologists cannot help but be destructive. Ever since we figured out how to light a fire, human presence has been making changes to the environment. Every bike, cup of green tea, every sheet of recycled paper, every fluorescent light bulb, every solar panel, every pair of organic cotton socks is the product of manufacturing that takes something from the earth, changes existing conditions somehow. It's time to admit we can't do anything about our human ways, so the best thing we can do for the planet is get off of it as soon as we can. So, the tired environmentalists of the world are beginning to say, okay, we give up. You were right all along. Buy it, spray it, nuke it, say it. Prodeg is the planet's only hope. And that was Deliberate Extinction Without Guilt by Paul Rafel and Donna Sheehan, who wrote this article for the Great Western Pacific Coastal Post, which is published monthly in Marin County, California. And now I would like to continue along the same lines with another story. How I Became a Born-Again Oppressor by Merciful Blasphemy. Hello, I would like to introduce myself to you. My name is Merciful Blasphemy. My friends call me Mercy, and my enemies, well, they don't call me. I am a little-known yet powerful worker within the Department of Human Services. I want to take a few moments of your time to share with you the story of my career. You see, I am a born-again oppressor. In my youth, I fought valiantly for the equal rights of all people, especially the poor, the powerless, the outcasts, and those victimized by the horror of domestic violence, rape, incest, and our American legal system. I was young. I was foolish. Why, I hadn't yet canceled my subscriptions to East West Journal, Ms. Magazine, and Mother Jones. I believed my little hands could help reform the world. I thought that a new moral consciousness was somehow stronger than corporate power. Ha! How far we allow our youth to stray from the American way. We are blessed with a governmental system that provides a momentary glimpse at the so-called idea of freedom before correcting such delusions and guiding us back online. It really is sad how many working adults still believe such visions. But such immature and blasphemous thinking has been cast from my small but humble brain. I see brilliance in the ways of simple oppression. A few individuals lead, the rest of us follow. Easy. As long as I remember to never complain and to co-opt my personal values, I really have no problems. I can be happy. If I cooperate, I may someday be assigned to a leadership role. But for now, I don't have to worry. That's what the leaders do. I don't have to think for myself. That's what the government does. It's like being a contented child. As long as I block the memories of my personal childhood horrors, I am comforted by my surroundings. I no longer struggle with my ideals. I don't wrestle with political correctness. I buy grapes anytime I want to. And I never feel overwhelmed nor burned out by the all-encompassing spirit of radical thought. I have been renewed by the energy of institutional power. This change was no easy task. I was a stubborn and rebellious young adult. I fought long and hard against this mental takeover. I used to speak out in unison with my brother and sister co-workers as we confronted management standards on poor working conditions, unsafe workplaces, affirmative action rights, equal rights for alternative lifestyles, and accessibility for differently abled clients. I was well-versed. I believed that language held power, and I knew the lingo. I was determined that every individual be given a voice and that every voice be heard. I helped define issues of empowerment. I drafted policy on client rights. I talked about covert violence as well as overt injustices. I demanded that, as an office, we confront each other on our own racist, sexist, classist, and homophobic statements, beliefs, and values. Together, office workers hung posters. We attended rallies. We marched in pride parades. We attended rallies. We wrote politically correct buttons and t-shirts. We were proud of our defiance. We were making a difference. The success of our frequent unity breaks and public demonstrations brought about community recognition. Because I was outspoken, I was viewed as the office spokesperson. The more notoriety I received, the more anxious my coworkers became. I began to hear whispered questions between restroom stalls. Could we be going too far? Are we rocking the boat a little too much? Could we lose our jobs? Our office unity began to break apart as coworkers feared the loss of their personal income more than the fear of management privilege or management retribution. After all, it was management who had hired each of us in the first place. Management eagerly picked up on the inner office fears and further divided the staff by manipulating the weakest individuals into opposing positions against the strongest workers. Co-workers spent their time fighting each other rather than against management rule, and they stopped speaking to me. Ah, the brilliance of oppression. It was a taste of true political savvy. And I, in my youth, still believed that we could bridge our disagreements, rekindle our common goals, and renew our pledge to provide equal and just social services. I was prepared for a positive confrontation between opposing powers that would instigate the eventual overthrow of the old patriarchal ways. I believed that, finally, justice would always avenge political violence. I was dedicated to hardcore radical persistence. The times were rapidly a-changin'. I was radiant, but no longer. I have been struck dumb by the truth of political oppression. In an instant, I grew wise to the ways of power and privilege. Why should I continue fighting someone else's battles when I could simply turn my back on certain issues that were not my personal issues? After all, I wasn't differently abled, so why should I care if the office was not accessible? I wasn't poor, so why should I work after hours when poor people didn't work at all? Why should I adapt my schedule to the need of clients? If they need my services, they will make a point to find me when I am available. Why use my time creatively? It only added hours to my day, compounded my paperwork, and was not a part of my job description. Why devote every weekend and several evenings each week to planning political actions when I could be home watching Designing Women and 30-something? Why be extra sensitive to the quality of clients' lives when they probably wanted that way of life to begin with? Why be sensitive at all? It wasn't in my job description. All that was expected of me was that I do my job on regular work time, comply with office standards, and maintain an adequate job performance. Was that asking too much? Yes, I am a born-again oppressor. I no longer desire the view from the mountaintop. I'm sitting on top of as much a mountain as I will ever have. Why complain about that? It's a nice enough view from here. It's such a relief. No more speak-outs and pride marches. No more rallies, no more consciousness-raising sessions. In fact, no more confrontations because I no longer have any complaints. Social oppression has always been here. I just needed to learn to accept it. I needed to grow up. I know now that those people who remain dissatisfied are simply unwilling to grow up and accept life as it is. Since my transformation, I have more personal time and more interest in socializing. I've played bridge with many important people in my community. I'm starting a morning jogging program with some others. Why, I've even joined a weight loss club with the city's most eloquent leaders. In fact, since I converted and threw away my old, overly radical ways, my office coworkers have started speaking with me again. We have regular staff lunches with management, and it's just the greatest plan. I realize how important it is to invest in office maintenance and is well worth the loss of direct client time. We need a break from our oh-so-difficult jobs so that we are more in tune with each other. We share recipes and discuss holiday plans. We have learned that entertainment is the apex of inner office support. After all, the office that eats together keeps together. I'm so glad that I have seen the light, and I want you to see the light as well. Speaking out against oppression is so divisive. I carried around so much anger when I was working against oppression. Anger is just another way of keeping hate alive, and we simply can't love one another if we remain angry at one another. I've learned to love myself. I now put myself first. When someone comes into the office filled with pain and misery, I simply love them for who they are. If they can't change, then I accept them as they are. I take the time to reach out to them with all my heart and encourage them to just say no to what is wrong in their lives. I teach them to understand their place in the world. I show them how happy I am. I'm happy for who they are. My job is much easier now and much more fulfilling. It is a privilege to work together in oppression. If more of us join together to fight against radical insight, then I know that social services would prove an unlimited success. After all, when you're the oppressor, you also control the statistics. And that was How I Became a Born-Again Oppressor by Merciful Blasphemy. At the time she wrote this, Merciful Blasphemy said she was upgrading her credentials so that she would be better equipped to enforce her power over those poor unfortunate souls who rely on social services, quote unquote. She lives on the North Coast and said she dwells within a local bureaucracy. And she wrote this story for the North Coast Times Eagle. And the earlier story, Deliberate Extinction Without Guilt, was also published in the North Coast Times Eagle. Now, to update a little bit, I'd like to read something by Robert Brake, who lives in Ocean Park, Washington. He just sent it to me a couple of days ago. Words matter, or should matter. It's cliches that are the problem with our stilted, overheated 2016 political discourse. It used to be that thinking people would say, with at least a modicum of pride, that their own convictions would not shrink to fit on a label or on a bumper sticker. But now it seems that the more vapid and vacuous the logo, the more charm it exerts. Take the "Yes, We Can" slogan from yesteryear. It's the sort of thing parents might chant encouragingly to a child slow on the potty training uptake. Yes, words like change and America abound in contemporary political rhetoric. Bill Clinton advocated for people for a change back in 1992. Obama urged change we can believe in 2008. That mantra was only slightly less banal and more cryptic than Hillary Clinton's various change slogans, working for change, ready for change, ready to lead, among them. And what about all those 2016 slogans touting or lamenting America? Hillary for America, Trump's Make America Great Again, Rubio's A New American Century, Ted Cruz's Reigniting the Promise of America, and Rand Paul's Unleash the American Dream. Pretty soon, we should be able to get electoral politics down to a basic newspeak that contains only 10 words. Dream, fear, hope, new people, we change America, future together. Fishing just from this tiny, stagnant pool of stock expressions, it ought to be possible to drive all of us thinking people away from the arena and leave matters to the gnarled but capable hands of the professional wordsmiths and manipulators. Perhaps we might encounter catchy new slogans like, healthcare, who needs it? Special interests and lobbyists, give them a break. Or, Dr. King's dream, what a snooze. It seems like the prevailing drivel assumes that every American adult is a completely illiterate jerk who would rather feel than think, and who must furthermore be assumed for a special reason for every 4 years to imagine everyone else in America, and that's in quotes, or in the country, also in quotes, is unemployed or starving or sleeping under a bridge. Yet, despite the wretched state of political language in 2016, I still subscribe to the unadorned, old-fashioned idea that words matter. Reviewing the landscape of slogan and cliché, all that I can say is that I only wish that this could once again be true. And that was Words Matter, or Should Matter, by Robert Brake, who is an essayist and retired educator and lives in Ocean Park, Washington, on the Long Beach Peninsula, and writes on many subjects of local and universal concern. And now, let us praise famous clowns. I don't mean the clown circus of presidential candidates provided by the gruesomely odious Primevals that masquerade as a political party dedicated to abolish everything sensible, humane, and humorous in human governance. The clowns we celebrate are Finnish lolgers, who scathingly mock a right-wing group that calls itself Soldiers of Odin, after an old Viking war god. The proto-Vikings are sour, ultra-right nationalists who are little different than American white supremacists, except perhaps their allegiance to a pagan deity, and there is more than a passing resemblance to leather-jacketed biker gangs, images of Odin on the backs of their jackets. They especially oppose Middle Eastern refugees and conduct vigilante patrols in Finnish cities to protect the citizenry from foreign erosion of Finlandia culture. These xenophobic bullies are contraposed with farcical slapstick by the clown-frocked lolgers, skipping through the streets with feather dusters, toilet brushers, and lollipops. The clowns flout the armed Odinites with LOL, laughing out loud with lots of love, brandishing lollipops. Send in the clowns. I would like to read a poem by Teresa Barnes of Astoria. Sometimes I feel like I don't understand anything. We paint our sidewalks green, you see. It's not on purpose, really. Once upon a time there lived wild and unspeakable, beautiful, tiny pieces of chlorophyll and magic before there was a sidewalk, before progress with a capital P that means concrete and big ideas, before we came, before we needed cars to drive ourselves to places we don't like. The green shoots remember everything and stubbornly defy us. They persevere ever upward, damn them, up through concrete, uncivilized and unspeakably alive. We persevere too, upward and unfalteringly angry, pouring death upon them, staining the sidewalk green, but still they refuse to die. They laugh at us in inaudible cries. It's not alive or soft beneath your feet, but even still it's green. We paint our history black, you see. It's not on purpose, really. Once upon a time there lived, wild and unspeakably beautiful, mothers and horses and naked babies, before there were boundaries to be defended, before war, with a capital W, that means blood-burnt crops and children dead, before we came, before we needed land to build boxes upon and fill with things that we don't need. Our history remembers everything and stubbornly defies us. It perseveres ever upward, damn it, up through schooling, uncivilized and unspeakably raw, inward and unfalteringly angry, pouring death on ourselves, leaving the young ones lost, but they refuse to forget entirely, damn them. We laugh at ourselves in ironical gasps. It's not alive or meaningful, but even still, it's here. And that was Teresa Barnes. Sometimes I feel like I don't understand anything. And this has been Michael McCusper. Happy Marple Mad Foolery.